Hello, welcome to another episode of the Telltale Heart Pharmacy Times podcast, the cardiovascular digest for pharmacists. I'm excited about our today's guest. Her and I have known each other for a long time, and I think she has a great, an amazing career trajectory, great things that she's been doing in the field. And I definitely am excited to dive in and talk to her about this and a recent study she's published. However, before we get into that, I want to do some housekeeping items. Just encourage listeners, if you enjoy what we're doing and enjoy the content we're providing you, please, A, reach out and let us know, or if there's something that you want to hear differently or things you would like for us to cover, please provide feedback. We're always happy to entertain ideas and options. But most certainly, also, if you want to hit like or subscribe, provide feedback that way, that would also be very helpful. And hopefully, maybe as we get reviews and comments, we'll provide feedback on that and what that looks like, and hear from you and let you guys be engaged in this process of creating this content and making it meaningful and empowering for you. So that's what I wanted to start out with, at least from the housekeeping perspective, to get in. But to not further delay, I want to jump straight into the content. And so I'm very excited to have Orly Vardeni on the podcast today. And I'm going to first turn over there. Orly, would you please introduce yourself and tell us about what your current role is?
Sure. First of all, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm just so pleased to be here and honored that you thought to include me. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I'm happy.
So as mentioned, my name is Orly Vardeni, and I'm currently located at the Minneapolis VA, the Veterans Affairs. And I have an academic affiliation with the University of Minnesota, so I'm a professor of medicine there. And my current role is as a clinical pharmacist. I spend one day a week seeing patients in an outpatient heart failure clinic, doing guideline-directed medical therapy, up titrations and management. And then 80% of my role is with research.
And that's what I've known you a long time, Morley, and I've just always been admired of how you have built your career, and I think it's good for people to hear if they're interested in this, like how you ended up getting into, your evolution of practice. And of course you may talk about this in a minute. I know you were at Wisconsin at one point and how all that changed. So just so people get a feel and flavor of how did you arrive into this, embedded world of heart failure research. And as you'll find out, she's been a lead investigator on some great studies. And we'll talk about that. Just so if people are wondering, how did you do this and what did you do? Or can you provide a brief overview of just what your journey has been like?
Sure. So I've been interested in research for a long time, since I was in high school, really. My first job was working in a lab. And I knew I was interested in research, but I also was even more interested in clinical care. So I went to pharmacy school at the University of Utah, and actually, University of Utah is where I did all of my training. So I did an ambulatory care residency after PharmD. And then while I was in residency, I got exposed to a rotation that focused on enrolling in clinical trials for hypertension. And I really enjoyed that rotation, and that led me to pursue a fellowship, which was also at the University of Utah. So I did that for 3 years before transitioning to my first academic position, which was at, as you mentioned, the University of Wisconsin in Madison. So that was my first job out of training. And so I felt prepared in terms of foundational aspects of research. I knew how to write a protocol. I knew how to enroll patients into clinical trials. I knew the logistics of how to do that, how to consent. But in terms of writing my own grants, I had probably limited exposure to that, because you just don't have enough time during a fellowship. And so when I was at the University of Wisconsin, I participated in a program run by the CTSA, the Clinical Science Translational Award. These are NIH infrastructure awards given by NCATS, the Institute of NIH, an institute within NIH. And it's an institutional K. So I participated in this program for 4 years, which is a mentored research program. And I had a multidisciplinary group of three mentors. One was a cardiologist, Nancy Schweitzer, who was there at the time. Second was an EP cardiologist, John Mikalski. And third was a statistician named Dave Demetz. So that really set the stage for majority of my research training and hands-on training. I got a master's while I did that program, and I learned how to write an R01. So that really was where things, I suppose, started. So while I was actually a junior faculty member, I was still very much developing my skills as a researcher.
No, that's awesome. So I think what I hear a few things, which is, and you can agree if I'm hearing you correctly or would add flavor to this. I definitely think the key is, identifying if this is your interest, getting some early exposure and confidence in, research and research techniques. And of course you gain some of that in residency and you've alluded, you got some of that in your fellowship exposure, but then identifying good solid mentors and mentorship and working through that and getting a feel for what you think your strengths are, maybe what your weaknesses are, and then being able to start working with them to identify and solve those types of problems. And to your point, you've done a structured master's that helped with that process. But I think the key is having the awareness, the inventory of what you want to do, the ability to understand what you need to do, and then the mentorship to help you guide through that. Is there's anything else I'm missing in that overarching theme or?
No, I think that is just beautifully articulated. I think the only thing that I would add is that even though Dr. Schweitzer, Mikalski, and Demetz were my formal mentors on paper with the institutional K, called the KL2 program, I had many other mentors that were maybe not formalized on paper, but that span from the School of Pharmacy where I was located to other institutions outside of University of Wisconsin. And so your mentoring team is that or should be vast because you learn different things from different people and different skills from different people and eventually develop your own style and your own style of mentoring others.
Right. And so just as you're thinking about this, if you had a student or a resident come to you, and you probably have this happen regularly, what do you give them as their first set of advice or, to kind of join that pathway? Do you always encourage, do a formalized program, or do you think it's just, that process of just being involved, getting engaged in something, even in theory, what if you have someone that's mid-career that's like, I'd like to do more in this space. What do you encourage to be your next steps for people?
I really feel like that the advice is very much individualized. I think early in a person's career, having something a little bit more structured and formalized is beneficial because then you get the foundation in addition to the hands-on experience. As the person is more mid-career, they've likely been exposed to a lot of the foundational aspects. So they may or may not need that classroom, if you will, type of learning. And likely more important is the doing, the hands-on, the being side by side with someone learning how to analyze data, how to plan out papers and next steps, and the intricacies of getting ready for a data monitoring committee meeting. Those types of things sometimes are just more difficult to learn in a classroom. And I feel like from that, from a mid-career person, it's best to do hands-on. So
Sure.
finding a mentor and learning from them, and then becoming a little more independent. I don't think you ever lose the need for mentorship. I still have several mentors, and I think I will for the rest of my career, people that I go to for advice. So it's just the type of learning and mentoring at your stage of career.
Sure. No, I would tell you, I agree with you. I think part of it, the biggest thing is just having the right people to talk to and working through it in a way that works for you. And I think, to your point about structure, programs are helpful and understanding what you need to get through those programs. But to your point, if you're later on and you don't have the ability or the process of structure, sometimes it's just doing and working through that process and being willing and acceptant and open to that. It's all about inventory of what you think you want to do and what you think your gaps are, but having that person you can talk to and help, or people or persons that can help you guide out of where you want to go and what the next steps are really critical. So I just love this in the sense, I don't know, when I was younger in my career, and this is why I'm thrilled to have this type of dialogue with you, is I've always admired, like, oh, I'd love to meet how these pharmacists that are doing these things, how did they get there? And if people are interested in it or are wanting to expand in it or see the how do they do that? And I think the message here, and I think it's beautiful what you've been saying, is that it is a little bit individual and it depends on where you're at and what you think you're doing. I think the big thing is to get a little bit out of your comfort zone if that's what you want to do, and just say, if I'm going to do this, I've got to try and figure out, if you don't know where your deficiencies are, where you need to grow in, how are you going to do that? Get that inventory and then start growing and being engaged and reaching out to people. And I think part of it is you have to let people know that that's what you want to do, right? So.
Yes, you absolutely have to advocate for yourself. Because if you realize you want to pursue something, but you need help doing it, the best way is to reach out to experts and get their advice and get their help.
Sure. Well, just to pivot a little bit, and I know we're going to talk specifically about one of your recent publications, but can you maybe describe, just so people have a flavor of the things you've gotten to do, some of your maybe either your most favorite project you've gotten to be a part of or have led, or, I know you've done great things, not to spoil your conversation around vaccines with cardiovascular disease, or just can you give a people a flavor of the breadth and depth of things that you've been able to contribute to in your career since you've done this great work.
Yes,
Thank you.
I've had a diverse, I guess, portfolio since the beginning, which you might argue is good and bad, because as an academic, they always want you to focus on a direction that will help you get promoted, to the next step. But I was always interested in several things. So I
Right.
pursued a couple of directions in parallel. And so the one direction I pursued is exactly as you mentioned, is viral infection and association with adverse cardiovascular outcomes and the roles of vaccine in potentially protecting from those outcomes. So with that, I actually started, that was my first direction at the University of Wisconsin. And some of my earlier research was actually lab-based research. I had a lab, with some other faculty members. We shared a lab. And so one of my first projects was to examine immune responses in people with heart failure to influenza vaccine. And my thought was, if people don't even respond to the vaccine, don't mount an appropriate immune response. Maybe they're not as well protected. And we know that people with heart failure are at higher risk for getting hospitalized when they do get influenza. So that was my first direction, which led to a small randomized study of double dose versus standard dose influenza vaccine. And that led to a larger study of a commercially available quadruple dose of influenza vaccine compared to standard dose. And it was an outcomes study looking at reduction in cardiopulmonary hospitalizations or mortality in people with high-risk cardiovascular disease. So that was probably, until now, that's my favorite because
Yeah.
it has a story. It started in a
Yeah, it's
test
a really
tube
good story. Yeah.
and it ended with a large trial. It was a neutral trial, but that's okay. We got the
No, that's
answer.
why we do research, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
So let me ask you this, just to add a layer to that question. You just happen to have this exposure to lab-based testing or lab-based research. If someone wants to do outcome research, do you feel that's a requirement? Or some people are like, well, I don't want to do lab benchtop, testing. What would you tell people that is that it's okay? You don't have to have the exposure to, that kind of T1 phase or, the lab top testing. That may be a reason people don't want to do that. You know what I mean? So.
Yes. Yeah. I agree with that. And that was me. I went into lab-based research because that was how I started and that's what I thought I wanted to do. But then I pivoted because it wasn't my passion and I left
Right.
the lab. So I would say if you know that lab work is not for you. And I didn't know. I thought it was, which is why I started off that way. But if you already know and have tried it or haven't tried it but have no interest, there's no reason really to focus on that. And I would say you don't have to have that. Having said that, my exposure to lab-based research helps me plan studies better. From a logistical perspective, from planning trials, because I understand the laboratory component. So it's helpful, but it's not absolutely necessary.
Well, and I think that's goes back to the conversation we had earlier, as depending on what you're, again, inventorying your strengths and weaknesses, you understand to partner with people who may have those strengths, right? As a part of your
Exactly.
team. I would argue, and maybe you would agree with this. I think you will. Research is a team-based sport, is what I would describe. So,
Yes.
yeah, very good. All right, we'll pivot again. So, I appreciate your view and oversight on your career and how you've gotten there. In case there are pharmacists or younger listeners or people that are just curious how you got there, and then, let's pivot and talk about one of your more recent publications with. It's a sub-analysis from the Fine Arts study looking at potassium, but maybe to give a little bit of context and equilibrium for everyone on who's listening, can you just briefly talk about A, finerenone for your perspective, like what is finerenone, and just describe that, and then secondarily, if you want to go into that, just talk a little bit about the larger Fine Arts study, and we'll reference both these studies and to our show notes so people can most certainly pull them in there and look at them themselves from that standpoint. But just to give some background before we get into your analysis, is I think we have to have that background so that we can understand what you've done with this study. So do you want to talk a little bit about what finerenone is and then talk about the Fine Arts study overall?
Yes, and I feel like I completely agree. We need a little bit of background, and that starts a little before finerenone, which is
Sure.
basically with MRAs or with steroidal MRAs in general, spironolactone and eplerenone, which we know are very strongly recommended in the guidelines, both European, US, Japanese, and others, as a class 1A recommendation for patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. And we have We have data in patients with mildly reduced or preserved ejection fraction with spironolactone, but the study that the only really large outcome study that we have is called TOPCAT, which was published about a decade ago and had a little bit of controversy. The study was neutral. It was spironolactone versus placebo in patients with symptomatic heart failure and ejection fraction of greater than or equal to 45%. Spironolactone did not significantly reduce the primary, which was a composite of cardiovascular death, resuscitated cardiac arrest, and oh my gosh, I'm blanking on the third thing. But it was neutral. And after that study was completed, a post-hoc analysis revealed some regional variations in efficacy of spironolactone, and regional variations in really the event rates were much lower in some parts of some regions that were included in the study compared to the Americas. So if you overall the study was neutral, but if you only looked at Americas, it would have been a positive trial. Of course, clinical trial purists are going to say, well, it's negative because the total study was negative. So with that background, finerenone is different than steroidal MRAs because it's a non-steroidal MRAs. MRAs are plagued with a couple of different types of adverse effects. One is hyperkalemia or elevations in potassium levels. And two, some steroidal adverse effects like gynecomastia, which are more frequent with spironolactone, which is less selective for the MR receptor compared to eplerenone, where at least the steroidal effects are not as common. Now they all have the effect of raising potassium. Finerenone is different in that it acts at the receptor a little bit differently. It's an inverse agonist as opposed to a partial agonist, which are the spironolactone and eplerenone MRAs. So because of that, there are some unique features, and that includes a little bit different in not just pharmacodynamics, but kinetic-wise, it has a shorter half-life. Unlike spironolactone, which has an active, long-acting active metabolite, finerenone does not have that, and finerenone does not have the steroidal adverse effects. Some people may argue that finerenone might have lower frequency of hyperkalemia, potassium greater than or equal to 5.5, compared to the steroidal MRAs, but there hasn't been a head-to-head, so I hesitate to really
Sure.
put too much on that.
Yeah, so in context that then it's a non-steroid agent, so in theory you're reducing, to your point, the steroidal based side effects for sure. That is definitely probably very clear, and it has maybe some more sensitivity and specificity for certain parts of tissue, whether it be kidney or heart, because we know it's also used currently in diabetic kidney disease, and we have separate trials for that, which we're not going to go into today. From that standpoint, just one thing about TopCat, and I know you alluded to this. I think what people need to appreciate is the, and I don't know what your thoughts are about this as a researcher. I mean, even when they looked at metabolites and what in theory people should be on treatment, they even demonstrated that patients weren't on treatment. You know, the people who should have been getting spironolactone, even it sounded like there's some trial variations where people that were on it weren't testing positive for metabolites that should have been there from that standpoint. So it just talks about, you know, making sure you have a good trial site selection and adherence to the protocol. Is that kind of what your thoughts are when you hear about or
Yes,
think about TopCat?
absolutely. Yes,
Yeah.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, in addition to, I mean, the varying event rates are just the tip of the iceberg and basically imply that there might be some site, specific non-adherence to the protocol, and there was probably non-adherence to study medication because of that metabolite differences. Individuals that said they were adherent reported high adherence in certain regions of the trial had virtually no serum metabolites. So obviously they were not adherent. So yes, that is definitely important to clarify.
So, and this is all great context because the real thing is we need treatments for HFpEF, for heart failure preserved ejection fraction. Of course, in the interim between TopCat and now, we've had some great developments. We've had some positive, semi-positive, I say semi-positive efforts for our ARNIs. We have TopCat that, depending on your interpretation, how you would implement that. Of course, we had positive results with the SGLT2 inhibitors, and so we're still continuing to search on how to better understand HFpEF and how to manage it. And of course, everybody wants to know because of the risk of fibrosis that occurs in this disease state. And we know that MRAs have some antifibrotic effects along with some other entities. How impactful are these agents, right? And so, of course, that leads us, like we're setting up, to FINEARTS. So, FINEARTS hopefully is going to answer this question. So, tell us about FINEARTS and then we'll get into your analysis. So,
Sure. So FINEARTS enrolled 6,001 individuals with heart failure with mildly reduced or preserved EF, so ejection fraction 40% or higher, and elevated natriuretic peptides and evidence of structural heart disease, randomized to finerenone or placebo. And the doses were based on the baseline GFR. So people with higher GFR got titrated to 40 milligrams of finerenone, and those with eGFR less than 60 got up to 20 milligrams a day. And then the primary was a composite of total worsening heart failure events or cardiovascular death. And total worsening heart failure events included heart failure hospitalizations as well as urgent heart failure visits or emergency room or outpatient visits where diuretics needed to be intensified. And the result was that finerenone resulted in 16% lower risk of the primary endpoint compared to placebo.
when you look at the breakout of this, it appears that the biggest driver of reduction was rehospitalizations or heart failure, hospitalization or visits to healthcare services for heart failure versus there was no reduction in CV death, correct?
That is correct, and that's
Right.
frequently, yes, observed with therapies that are testing in HFpEF. It's very tough to show reduction in cardiovascular death
And
because
that
of
is.
competing risks,
Yep. Yep. Disease states and comorbidities. Exactly. For sure. But it was interesting, and we won't get into the full analysis of the study. There's also interesting considerations about, time to benefit and other things potentially that could be indicative of atrial fibrillation. And those are all great sub-analysis. We can put those in the show notes as well if people are interested. But more importantly, I can't wait to jump to this. Orly got the great chance. And I'm not, to do the potassium kind of analysis. So tell us about your analysis of this population. And then maybe before we jump directly into this, how did you get engaged in the fine arts study? And how did you, what was your role into that process to tie it to our earlier themes?
Yes. So to tie to the earlier theme, if one wants to get involved in clinical trials and clinical trial leadership, the best way in is to enroll well in a clinical trial in whatever disease state you're interested in. And so I did that for a study called Paragon HF of sacubitril/valsartan in HFpEF. And with that, I got some exposure and experience and was asked to be one of the national lead investigators for the US for the Fine Arts study. So, because of my role there's opportunities to be involved in some of the academic output of trials. And so, it was definitely an interest of mine. I had done some analyses previously with RALS looking at potassium specifically. And the prognostic significance of elevations of potassium with MRAs. So I was interested in replicating some of those analyses with fine arts because something that clinicians often ask is, we know MRAs increase potassium, but what does that mean and how do I respond to that? Because the most frequent response to elevations in potassium that are even above 5.0, going to 5.2, is to stop the MRA, which
Yeah.
is absolutely the worst thing we can do.
Well, and I tell you, argumentatively, in my opinion, it's the biggest, in my theory, driver of inertia with mRNAs is this fear of hyperkalemia. And, if you look at all the studies that look at whether it be HFpEF or ref, I mean, most people never really got to life-threatening degrees of hyperkalemia. And no
Exactly.
one actually dies of hyperkalemia in these studies.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it just is. It's an error of omission type opportunity, and so I think it. And actually, one of your results, or one of the results, and I don't think you talk about this in your study. I want you to get to the results, but I think what's interesting is in heart failure, I think the thing that is not talked enough about is hypokalemia, and really the risk that it actually inserts itself into. But let's talk about your analysis and what did you find based on this.
So we looked at frequency of potassium levels greater than 5.5 and greater than 6.0 by treatment assignment. And then we looked at across the spectrum of potassium values after the study medication was titrated, what were the relative event rates for the primary outcome between finerenone and placebo. And what we found was that potassium abnormalities, as exactly as you mentioned, at the lower end of the potassium spectrum, as well as at the higher end of the spectrum, regardless of treatment assignment, were both associated with an increased risk. So both hypokalemia and hyperkalemia are associated with an increased risk for the primary outcome. But that if you look at the spectrum of potassium, post-randomization potassium levels or 3 month potassium levels, the efficacy of finerenone is maintained. The event rates for the primary outcome are still lower with finerenone than placebo, even at higher potassium levels. And obviously, there's an inflection point at which the potassium level is high enough that you no, may no longer get a benefit. With RALS, we think that inflection point is about 5.8. Likely with finerenone, that is right around there, or maybe even a little higher. But something that we can't ignore is that, of course, investigators were instructed to adjust dosage levels when
Right.
potassium levels were elevated. But the bottom line is that the benefit of finerenone is maintained even at higher potassium levels.
Yeah, and that's so my takeaway from this, and I want to hear if this is yours or you agree, is that we need to be more confident in being okay or comfortable with it being a little, if it's a little bit above five. That the knee-jerk reaction shouldn't be the world is ending and we're going to pull off therapy. You can make other adjustments or whatever that may be. And of course, in this day and age, we have lots of opportunities or ways to manage potassium. And I don't know if you want to speak to this. Of course, people always talk about partnering with SGLT2s. I don't know if you did in your analysis. I can't remember if you had a specific subset of, I know there's analysis with SGLT2s in a certain percentage in the overall study, but I don't know if you comment specifically if there was a difference in yours. I can't recall of that analysis, or if you didn't publish it and you know the answer to that question. But just the more thematic conversation I'm having is we need to be comfortable with potassium being a little elevated because we can manage through that, or there's still a benefit there at that, mildly elevated range versus knee-jerk reaction is what I call that in terms of stopping therapy. So I don't know if that's your message you would say for your
Yes,
analysis, or you agree
that's
on this.
perfectly stated.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the
And
reason we
then
did this analysis, was to show that even when you get to 5.5, there's still a benefit of finerenone versus placebo. Of course, realizing that people on placebo that have a potassium of 5.5 are obviously sick for other reasons, but
Sure.
nonetheless, that is still a message that we wanted to impart.
Yeah, and I think the message I see, and just knowing there's not a lot of focus on it and looking at this in the literature, is the hypokalemia to me appears to have a bigger risk. And we need to do better data to find this in terms of death and outcomes. And of course, in the larger trial, finerenone had a lower rate of hypokalemia compared to placebo, but I think that's the area we need to probably spend more time thinking about and not worrying as much about the hyperkalemia. Now, and I get that it's hard to think about this contextually in a medical legal system, and we have to think about those things, but I think there are clearly ways that we can manage and protect these patients and keep them on therapy overall, and help optimize their outcomes from a potential readmission. And to the point, and maybe this is another message, is they don't need to be seen or readmitted or sent to the hospital if they're only at a 5 or 5.5 or something. There's no need to provide this excess care process, or we could do additional monitoring or something to that effect to
Yes, and
manage
the
these
best thing you can
patients.
do is retest the potassium
Correct.
because you'll find a lot of times it's then no longer at that high level, which is comforting to see.
Perfect. All right, this is great. So any other things you would say from this study that you would, or your trial that you would translate into practice? And
I think the point you made about re MRAs reducing the risk for hypokalemia can't be underemphasized. And it's
yeah.
not something, as you said, that's often talked about and thought of as a potential benefit of MRAs, but I think it's something that we should amplify.
Yeah, absolutely. Very good. Well, this has been amazing, and you have done such amazing things, and I admire you all the time, and I'm thrilled that we know each other and get to see each other and partner on things. And when I thought about it, I was like, I have to have Orly on, and I'm sure we'll have you in the future again because you're always doing outstanding things, so I appreciate the time. And so kind of my last question, we always ask our guests non-clinical questions. So tell me, if you want, what have you been reading or watching or listening to that is not cardiology related that you would recommend for our listeners?
Yeah, that's a good question. So let's see, what I've been watching most recently is the second season of Severance,
Yes.
which is just a very interesting and odd, which is why I love it.
It's so interesting. Everyone has mentioned Severance, and I haven't gotten to watch it yet. But the past several people I've talked to, that has been the thing. And I started Succession, so I'm trying to get through that.
Oh, I've heard good things.
Yeah, and so we will have to get onto that when I have it in the queue because everyone says it's so good. So,
Yes, you have to be prepared that it's unusual.
okay.
But
Well, I like.
you have to embrace that.
I listen, I like creative things and unusual things, so I think I'll be good on that. But Orly, if people wanted to find you on, do you have a web, do you have your faculty website? Do you have social media? Do you do Twitter or X? How would they find you?
I don't, I have to say I don't tweet very often, but I do have an
Sure.
X account, at Orly Vardani, and I'm on LinkedIn as well.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you talking to us about this. And like I said, we'll have all these studies listed in our show notes so people can look at them and engage and most certainly ask us if there are questions. I appreciate Orly you doing this. For anybody, again, reminder, if you have comments or questions or want to see certain content, please let us know. And if you are interested in providing feedback on the podcast, please, we would love to hear it. So I thank you for the time, and then we'll join next week where we're going to talk about some, interestingly, translational work about how we get people to do guideline-directed medical therapy through EHR-based interventions. So join us next time on this. So, thank you all.